Well, that's a little Amazing Grace there, introducing us here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show with your show host, Andrew Herrod, where we like to examine important current events for conservatives and others. And here we're thinking of Amazing Grace and grace for the unborn. And I think in particular, we should note the figure in Roe v. Wade, the 1973 decision. Norma McCorvey ultimately had a pro-life conversion on the matter, even though she was the central figure in this 1973 decision, which is now going to come up on for review in a case which the Supreme Court recently last May authorized a review, certiorari, or cert, as it's said in legal parlance, to look at Roe v. Wade in a case from Mississippi, Dobbs v. Jackson's Women's Health Organization, which will test a Mississippi law prohibiting abortion after 15 weeks of fetal gestation, except in medical emergencies and severe fetal abnormalities. And to discuss these important issues, we have Clark Forsythe, the Senior Counsel for Americans United for Life, and also as a late addition to the show, Michael New, a prominent commentator on life issues at National Review and elsewhere, and a professor at Catholic University here in Washington, D.C. Well, welcome to the show, both of you, Michael New and Clark Forsythe.
Thanks for having us.
Well, just starting out here, this has been a very momentous development here at the Supreme Court. What would be the possibility for the Supreme Court in this Dobbs case to overturn Roe v. Wade?
Well, I think it's possible, but not likely. There are a number of hurdles and constraints and limits on what the court might do in this case. For example, Mississippi has yet to even ask the court to reconsider any precedent, hasn't asked the court to reconsider Roe versus Wade. I think my job as a litigator before the court is to persuade the court to take the biggest possible step toward overturning Roe. And the decision will come out. It will be argued in November, likely, and with a decision by next May.
Well, okay. So if what would then be possible legal outcomes in this case? If you're saying it's not likely that Roe would be overturned in its entirety, could the court uphold the Mississippi law, this 15-week ban on abortions after 15 weeks, while leaving Roe intact?
Yes. The court has a lot of discretion. And, of course, it's not just one judge. It's nine judges. How they might come out on this remains to be seen. But there are the way I like to say it is that the court can take tiny steps, small steps, or big steps toward overturning Roe versus Wade. My job is to persuade them to take the biggest possible step. Obviously, it's possible, but I think it's highly unlikely. Mississippi could lose. I hope at the very least, the court will uphold this 15-week limit, which large majorities of Americans would approve. But it is possible, but not likely, that the court could overturn Roe. But I don't think we should minimize the significance if the court did uphold this 15-week limit. It would be the most momentous decision since 1973 and Roe versus Wade itself. It would allow limits on late-term abortions to go into effect in many states. I think a number of other states would copy this law. So it would be very significant, and no one should minimize what it would mean. The court, when it's overturned past decisions, it's sometimes taken one or two or three steps toward doing this. So even if the court didn't overturn Roe in this case, it could do so in two or three steps.
Well, okay. That's an interesting – I've heard commentary on that before. What do you think – looking at the lineup of the Supreme Court, what do you think – what would be to look for in the particular justices? Do any of the justices particularly stand out in their approaches to abortion and what they might do or advocate?
Well, Justice Thomas, in particular, for the last several years, has written a number of opinions basically calling upon his colleagues to reconsider and overrule Roe versus Wade. Justice Thomas right now is the only justice who has come out publicly, avowedly against Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the 92 decision, and advocated the overturning of Roe and urged his colleagues to address it head on and to overturn it as an illegitimate decision. We have two conditions now at the court that we have never had since 1973, two positive conditions. The first is we have a six-justice majority that I would call, at the very least, abortion skeptical. We've never had that since 1973. The addition of Justice Barrett when she was confirmed last fall has been a huge change and a positive one, I believe. And the second condition is that there are at least 40 abortion cases in the lower federal courts heading to the court. There's a traffic jam on abortion cases heading to the court. And most of the decisions in the past have been kind of one-off. But the court now has knows that there are many cases in the lower courts, and they can pick and choose among those as to what case they might want to address next. They know they can take two or three steps toward overturning Roe. And so what we are not lacking is a wealth of cases that could give the court the opportunity to do so.
Oh, Michael New, did you have something you want to add?
Right. I generally agree with everything Parker's saying. I think if you just look at the history of Supreme Court jurisprudence, they tend to move incrementally. They're a lot more likely to make kind of an incremental decision than a sweeping decision. So that's why I'm a little bit skeptical they're going to use the Mississippi case as an opportunity to overturn Roe v. Wade. I'll also say that if you look at the way kind of John Roberts has conducted himself as Chief Justice, he seems to be somebody who's kind of very interested in kind of building consensus. I think that if he can get a six-vote consensus to uphold the Mississippi law, I think he would prefer to do that versus a five-vote razor-thin majority to overturn Roe v. Wade. So I think Justice Roberts is going to be searching for a way to get six judges to agree to something, and I think that's going to kind of steer the court to kind of a more incremental sort of outcome than a sweeping decision that would overturn Roe v. Wade.
Yeah, I guess Roberts would be a key figure. He's been someone I guess people have commented on that he really sort of thinks politically about the court. I mean, the key thing people always think about of John Roberts was the whole Obamacare decision, where he was looking for all these kind of, I forget what it was called, like twistifications or something, look for any way to sort of get out and sidestep any kind of overruling of this health care law and just get the court out of it and let, leave it to politics. So he's someone who really concerned about that. I have heard this before that, people would look to the whole issue of abortion and they'd want to take this gradual position, not like a big bang, one decision that just takes out Roe, but, over time, sort of reflect upon it, rule upon it case after case and set a pattern. What would be a sort of a precedent for that? What other issues has the Supreme Court treated with before where they've taken a kind of a gradualist perspective?
Well, one example I would give would be public sector union dues. Union dues in the public sector that is run by the state, and so such public unions are limited by the First Amendment because they're state agencies. And the court in Janus in 2008 overturned a 1977 decision called Abood, which had allowed coercive public sector dues. But the court in Janus, after one or two or three prior decisions, I think there were two prior decisions before Janus in 2008, they kind of cut back on Abood. And then finally in Janus, they said public sector unions can't coerce dues. And I think there could be other examples where the court, when overturning even a major decision, has done so in two or three swipes rather than just all of a sudden. But I don't think we should underestimate the significance of Justice Barrett joining the court, because let's give Chief Justice Roberts the benefit of the doubt. I mean, if you're sitting in his chair, a 5-4 overruling of Roe would have been inherently unstable, because the loss of one of the five could have turned the court around, and the overruling of Roe could have been overruled 5-4. A 6-justice or even a 7 or 8-justice overruling is much more stable, more enduring. And so the 6th justice, the substitution of Justice Barrett for Justice Ginsburg, was a huge development. And it gives the 6 more room, I would say, and Chief Justice Roberts more room as to how to decide this case or the next abortion case.
Yeah, well, looking at, you know, we have new justices here. Think of the other justices. What about Samuel Alito? Has he indicated anything like, say, Clarence Thomas? You know, he's sort of seen as another sort of key conservative on abortion. Or then, of course, well, with Trump, we've had Barrett, and then we've had Kavanaugh and Gorsuch that were all put on. Is there anything to comment there on those justices?
Well, they have not, Alito, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, have not come out publicly and avowedly opposed Roe versus Wade and urged that it be overturned. Roberts has not either. But in the June Medical versus Russo decision from Louisiana in June of 2020, last June, Gorsuch wrote a critical opinion about the court's abortion doctrine, and Alito has been increasingly critical. So I think that both are quite skeptical about the disastrous impact of Roe versus Wade on the court, and have at least been critical, even if they have not yet come out and said that Roe should be overturned. So I would count them as kind of allies. Kavanaugh also would have upheld the Louisiana law that imposed clinic regulations, but he also has not yet come out in favor of overturning Roe. This Mississippi case, the Dobbs case, will give all of them an opportunity to say more about the court's abortion doctrine and Roe versus Wade, and I hope to see them as even more openly critical.
Well, Michael New, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, I think that I agree with what Clark had to say. As far as kind of situations where the Supreme Court has reversed precedent incrementally, I think the civil rights movement offers some good examples. I think one of the first major wins for the civil rights movement was a case that involved desegregating public law schools. And I think that was an important win for a variety of reasons, in part because after law schools were desegregated, that helped train a new generation of civil rights lawyers. So I think that's a good example of kind of how the court often will move incrementally. As far as the individual justices, I think that, Clark is right that Clarence Thomas is really the only judge we have on the court who has publicly said that, Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided. His jurisprudence, I'm pretty sure that Alito has pretty much voted to uphold every pro-life law that he's at least been voted on as a member of the Supreme Court. So, again, I think that, Clark is certainly correct that you have at least 6 judges that are abortion skeptical. How that will shake out regarding this case remains to be seen.
I would add that Michael's point about civil rights is an excellent one and an excellent example. Plessy versus Ferguson, which first upheld racial segregation by Southern states, was decided in 1896. So there were 58 years between Plessy versus Ferguson and Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, which threw out racial segregation. But between Plessy and Brown, there were a number of decisions related to racial segregation. And after the 30s, there were three or four which had struck down racial segregation. Michael gave the example of universities and colleges, but there were others too. And so the NAACP and their strategy knew the court, as Michael has said, sometimes overturns incrementally. And they were looking to, you know, put together a series of cases that would lead to the ultimate overruling. And they were, their strategy was savvy and they were successful.
Well, you talk about a wealth of cases coming up to the Supreme Court or in the judiciary, this sort of traffic jam of abortion cases, which I've also has occurred to me that, you know, we just keep hearing of all these laws and states around the country, not just Mississippi, but, you know, say bans on abortion after fetal heartbeats are detected, you know, after about, like, I guess after the 25 weeks or so, and they're just popping up all day. What would be if going after this law, I mean, I guess assuming that this abortion skeptical attitude of the court, that this law gets held up, upheld, what would be another law that would come down this judicial pipeline here that the Supreme Court might look at?
Well, there's a kind of an urban legend out there that the court has to have the perfect case with the absolute prohibition and the perfect record before they can readdress overturning Roe. But as a legal matter, the fact is that they can overturn Roe versus Wade in any abortion case in which a state statute arguably conflicts with Roe versus Wade. It could be a parental notice case. It could be an informed consent case. It could be the 15-week case. It could be a heartbeat case or a 12-week limit. The court can do so in any of these cases. The advantage that we now have that we haven't had is that there are these wealth of cases, and Thomas, as an avowed opponent of Roe, I expect he is looking at what is coming before the court and helping the justices to decide what case to take next after Mississippi's.
Yeah, I guess, you know, that's an interesting point. You know, there's if you're looking for a judicial battleground and shaping a strategy here, there is just increasingly any number of different laws and cases you could take, depending on what any justice thinks might be the best strategy. Looking at this 15-week law, now I guess where the precedent we have here in Roe and its successor cases is the 1992 Planned Parenthood v. Casey case, which modified Roe and said that laws have to pass this on abortion, this undue burden test, that they cannot impose an undue burden. Is that then the way that the court could uphold the Mississippi law that, well, yeah, it's just not an undue burden? This undue burden, as Clark has written, is, you know, not really defined. So I guess, can the court just simply say, yeah, it's not an undue burden, 15 weeks still allows you possibility to procure an abortion?
They could say that. It's often been pointed out that undue burden is so vague and subjective that, for example, Justice Scalia would have said that nothing is an undue burden, but Justice Ginsburg would have said that anything is an undue burden. It's very inherently vague and arbitrary and subjective, but the court could use that language and say that Mississippi's 15-week limit is not an undue burden. They could say that it protects legitimate state interests, like protecting maternal health, protecting fetal life, and it's a legitimate law to serve those interests. I mean, it could use a number of different words and standards to uphold it.
What do you think, Michael? Yeah, you're involved with a lot of legislation. What do you think?
Well, one thing that I've read and have thought about is that one thing that's been pointed out is that there's only one abortion facility left in Mississippi, and it's my understanding that they will not do abortions after 16 weeks gestation. So one conceivable outcome is that if this law does take effect, it would only really have the effect of limiting abortions between 15 and 16 weeks gestation, which I imagine don't happen all that often in Mississippi. So I could see a scenario where the court says, look, based on the fact there's one abortion facility in Mississippi and they only do abortions, through 16 weeks gestation, this law is really not going to affect all that many people. It doesn't really pose an undue burden, and therefore we're going to uphold the law. I could see a scenario where the pro-life movement wins on kind of narrow, technical, state-specific grounds. That would not be the best outcome. It'd be good to have a stronger decision that would kind of make it easier to pass 15-week abortion limits elsewhere. So it would be an incremental win for the pro-life movement, but it wouldn't be as strong a win as it could be.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it's been noted in this case, Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, again, that this Jackson Women's Health Organization in the capital of Mississippi, Jackson, Mississippi, is indeed the last abortion clinic in Mississippi. So, yeah, that's an interesting point. If some other 15 weeks law or similar law were to come up in another state, there'd be a question of it's having a much more severe impact, whereas here in Mississippi, this is the only facility in the state, and as Michael indicated, it doesn't really perform abortions beyond 15 weeks. Only it's sort of a margin of 15 to 16 weeks here. So yeah, that's an interesting point. Do arguments still exist for upholding Roe v. Wade? I mean, Clark here has discussed precisely this undue burden. Does any of this jurisprudence, any of these Supreme Court decisions make any sense?
Well, not from my opinion. The Roe versus Wade has been a disaster for the court. It's caused a political upheaval across the country. It's undermined the Supreme Court nomination and confirmation process since it was decided. But you can bet certainly that the ACLU and the Center for Reproductive Rights and abortion advocates across the country will be filing dozens of briefs in the court, urging the court to stick to Roe versus Wade. And a couple of arguments, which of course I don't hold to, but that would include the age of the decision. Roe versus Wade is 48 years old, and people expect it to continue to be the law, that women have come to rely upon it, that the court in 92 in Casey basically retained Roe versus Wade because they said that women had come to rely upon abortion for equal opportunity in American society. That may be the most compelling argument that would be made. I don't think it holds water, but I expect to see it.
Yeah, I remember that reliance argument years ago when the Casey decision in 1992 came out. Is that true? What arguments would you make against that? Is it an undue burden argument that if you still have some abortion possibilities, or maybe make an argument, not many abortions happen after 15 weeks anyway, so you're not really hindering that reliance?
That's correct. Very few women rely upon late-term abortion or rely upon abortion until fetal viability. I think that's very clear about this particular law. But I think that there have been significant factual and social changes since 73 that undermine the whole notion that women rely upon abortion for equal opportunity in American society. Michael knows better than anyone about the drop in the significant drop in the abortion rate. And I think that shows less reliance. Truly, if American men and women rely on anything, it's contraception more than abortion. In addition, I would say that overturning Roe doesn't mean the court makes abortion illegal. Overturning Roe doesn't mean that some federal law comes back into effect that would prohibit abortion, or that even laws in 50 states would come back into effect that would prohibit abortion. Overturning Roe means the issue is returned to the states. The states have diverse positions on abortion. And while perhaps a dozen states would prohibit it or limit it very strongly, the day after Roe was overturned, abortion would still be available in probably up to fetal viability or 20 weeks in perhaps 30 states. So I think the pro-life movement will win over the long term, but there would not be immediate a drastic change if the court overturned Roe versus Wade.
Right. Dovetailing on what Clark said, I think this is very good audience, very good evidence that women are, quote-unquote, relying on abortion less and less. Since 1980, the U.S. abortion rate has fallen by over 53%. So that means that, you know, we see a significant increase in the percentage of unintended pregnancies being carried to term. And since 1980, you know, with the falling abortion rate, you know, we've seen women doing better and better by a variety of metrics. Women are earning a higher percentage of bachelor's degrees. They're earning a higher percentage of master's degrees. They're earning a higher percentage of doctorates. Women's earnings are going up. Women's earnings relative to men are going up. So all these positive trends are happening during a time when abortions are becoming less and less frequent. So it seems pretty hard to argue that women are relying on abortion when abortion rates are falling, and by many professional and academic and economic metrics, women are doing much, much better.
Yeah, I mean, all of these, reliance and how are women doing and so forth, I guess, again, it really emphasizes the political nature of abortion and the Roe v. Wade decision. And the subsequent decisions at the Supreme Court, it emphasizes, as you've indicated, that the Supreme Court will want to take really sort of a very political, gradualist approach to this issue, sort of going with the flow, sort of going in tandem with political opinion. So has the Supreme Court just become kind of a weather gauge on abortion, or it's sort of as Clark mentioned, sort of the nation's sort of abortion board of health, or I think you said?
Well, I think, Michael, if you just look, you know, at a lot of jurisprudence, I mean, public opinion does play a role. I think that's unfortunate. I think the Supreme Court should make decisions based on the text of the Constitution and what the founders intended when they wrote the Constitution. But I think, practically speaking, public attitudes do matter. And I think that, to a certain extent, the Supreme Court misinterpreted public attitudes toward abortion in the Roe v. Wade decision. I think that they thought that Roe v. Wade would be similar to the previous cases they ruled on that involved contraception. You know, they kind of, after these contraception cases, you know, some Catholic bishops were unhappy and shook their fists. But by and large, almost all Americans made their peace with a world where contraception was widely available. That didn't happen with abortion. You know, we really have not made our peace as a country in a situation where abortion is legal on demand throughout all 9 months of pregnancy in all 50 states. So, you've seen them try to, pull back a little bit. You know, they have upheld certain kinds of incremental pro-life laws like parental involvement laws and waiting periods and informed consent laws. They, in 1980, did rule that limitations on taxpayer funding of abortion were constitutional. But this is the first time they've really considered the constitutionality of a gestational age limit. So, again, I think that, again, the polling shows very clearly that Americans oppose third trimester abortions. Americans oppose second trimester abortions. In fact, the Associated Press just released a poll today They found that 80% of Americans oppose third trimester abortions in all or most cases, and 65% oppose second trimester abortions in all or most cases. So, it's possible that the ruling, the initial ruling, that frankly is in fact consistent with public opinion.
And I would add two thoughts. One is that when the court issued Roe versus Wade, it took control of the abortion issue in every state and county, and took control of abortion regulations for every abortion clinic across the country. And it made itself, the court, the center of abortion politics in the nation. And that has been disastrous for the court. My argument against kind of incrementally overturning Roe and taking it in two or three swipes is that the court should release its grip on the abortion issue as soon as possible, for the nation, for our politics, and for the court itself. And it should decentralize the issue and return it to the states. And the second observation I have is that since 1973, in the aftermath of the Roe versus Wade decision, the states have passed laws that protect the unborn child outside the context of abortion, say in the case of a drunk driver or a estranged boyfriend who assaults his pregnant girlfriend, or a bank robber who goes into a bank and shoots a pregnant woman. The states have increasingly passed fetal homicide laws that treat the killing of an unborn child as a homicide, as the killing of a human being. And just this spring, Wyoming became the 31st state with a fetal homicide law from conception. So the courts created this legal schizophrenia in which it opposes abortion on demand from coast to coast, but 31 states have fetal homicide laws from conception.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Yeah, the fetal homicide laws, I've come across, read about it a little bit, but that's obviously the strange set of affairs that, a woman can legally procure an abortion, but then any damaging of the woman that results in the death of an in utero baby, then is a homicide. Yeah, that's very illogical. Well, looking at Roe v. Wade, Michael here mentioned various statistics on public perceptions of abortion and what sort of time limits they support and so forth. I mean, on the other hand, supporters of Roe, they'll often say, Roe enjoys widespread American support. I mean, do American people even know what's in Roe? Or is there a sort of a false advertising here as to claims that the American people support Roe?
Right. I think the polling on Roe v. Wade, to be perfectly honest, is kind of worthless as far as explaining what Americans feel about abortion. And most of the polling you see on Roe v. Wade has kind of two shortcomings. The first shortcoming is that a lot of these polls don't really explain what Roe v. Wade did. Roe v. Wade effectively legalized abortion on demand in all 50 states throughout all 9 months of pregnancy. That's a policy outcome that is approved by a relatively small percentage of Americans. In fact, some polls even mislead people and try to create the impression that Roe v. Wade only legalized abortion in the first trimester, which is, very, very misleading. The second problem with a lot of the polling on Roe v. Wade is it doesn't explain what happens if Roe is reversed. Many people think if Roe v. Wade is reversed, abortion is banned everywhere. That's not the case. If Roe is reversed, the decision goes back to the states, where various state legislatures and governors will have the opportunity to make abortion policy in their respective states. So these polls that claim that 60-70% of Americans support Roe v. Wade are just very misleading.
Yeah, and I guess does that then tie in with this incrementalist approach that if you have more and more of these laws, like a 15-week law from Mississippi, that really makes the issue of abortion concrete? I mean, if you really – and then that would really make Americans sort of focus on the issue and just what exactly is the Supreme Court deciding?
Right.
That's exactly right.
That, that this, you know, is going to kind of increase the salience of, you know, limits on second and third trimester abortions, where I think that puts the debate on very favorable terrain for pro-lifers. We saw in the mid-1990s debate over the partial birth abortion ban, I think, was certainly useful for pro-life people. I think that it did highlight how extreme abortion policy was. The fact that I think President Clinton vetoed a partial birth abortion ban on two occasions, I think, really showed the extremism of many Democrats on this issue. And, you know, I'm thinking that, you know, something similar could happen here. I think that once people learn more about fetal development, once they learn more about how unborn children at certain stages of gestation can feel pain, they're a lot more sympathetic to the pro-life position.
Do you have anything to add, Clark?
I would also add that this the 15-week limit passed by Mississippi was also enacted by the legislature to protect maternal health from the risks of late-term abortions, and that has not been given the media and the focus it needs to. Late-term abortions have an greatly increased risk of maternal mortality. There is a fine 2004 medical journal study, which is pretty much applauded across the spectrum, the medical spectrum, the philosophical spectrum, very well done, that found that the maternal mortality rate rises considerably after 12 weeks, after 16 weeks, and after 20 weeks. And it just goes through the roof after 20 weeks. So this law was also passed to protect women from the risks of late-term abortions. And those risks need to be more widely understood.
Well, if we look at Roe v. Wade, you know, Michael was making his point that, you know, the Supreme Court back in 73, they thought, the American people will just sort of accept this like they accepted, say, the 1965 Griswold v. Connecticut decision on contraception. And there they made a mistake. How has the legal establishment treated Roe v. Wade and, say, law schools and so forth? If, as you've indicated, Roe v. Wade and its later cases like the Casey decision from 1992, they just don't really make any sense. I mean, how has this jurisprudence survived?
Well, the legal academy in the United States is, frankly, a hotbed of pro-abortion sentiment. Law schools are one of the most exclusive institutions in the United States, and there are very few pro-life law professors and very few students who would admit to being pro-life. So the legal academy does not reflect public opinion and the views of the public that Michael talked about. But on the other hand, the law reviews, the journals put out by law schools, have over the years been very critical of the Supreme Court's decision in Roe versus Wade and how badly done it was, the negative impact it had, how illogical it was, the historical mistakes made in the Roe opinion, which I discuss in great detail in my 2013 book, Abuse of Discretion, The Inside Story of Roe versus Wade. So the legal academics, in some sense, have been very critical of the Roe decision. And frankly, that's one factor that the court has traditionally pointed to in overturning a decision, how, you know, whether it's been accepted by judges or rejected, or whether it's been accepted by the bar and the legal community or not.
You have anything to add on that, Michael?
I mean, it's interesting. When, you know, Roe v. Wade was, you know, first handed down, it seemed that it got a lot more scrutiny from law professors and the legal profession. I know John Hart Eli was a well-known law professor at Yale, and if I understand correctly, even was sympathetic to legal abortion, but just thought that Roe v. Wade was just bad jurisprudence. And it seemed that that was a fairly somewhat conventional opinion for a lot of law faculty at one point, that they might have been sympathetic to the idea of legal abortion, but just thought that, Roe v. Wade was just bad jurisprudence, didn't really reflect what was in the Constitution, and as a result received law criticism. That's kind of been muted in recent years. I mean, I think as the law profession and especially the academy has shifted to the left, especially on these social issues, you don't hear those kind of criticisms today as much as you used to. But at one point, Roe was widely criticized. It was not, there was certainly not a strong consensus that it was good constitutional law the way some people might think.
Yeah, I think if I recall correctly, John Hart Eli was the one who said that, this Roe v. Wade decision, it's just not constitutional law. I mean, it was some comment like that was made. It was just totally dismissive. I mean, I personally once years ago read the Roe v. Wade decision. I think it was like back in college or maybe later. And, I looked at it and I thought, I don't know. I've written better things in ninth grade than this. I mean, it just didn't make any sense. It seemed to have like just like a little review of abortion history. And then it just sort of came out and said, well, gosh, there's never been any clear decision on abortion in legislation. So we'll just, make this statement that, there's a right to abortion and, all laws will be overturned in Roe v. Wade, as well as, and additionally, as you've indicated in its companion decision, that Roe v. Wade is always read in conjunction with the Doe v. Bolton decision, which gave the standard that, abortion has to be allowed for any health reason and defined as including, anything like mental health or anything. So just basically, any woman expressing opposition to a pregnancy and saying that's going to affect my life, that then counts as health. Thinking about Clark mentioned this, thinking about the legal establishment and the judiciary, Scalia talked about this, that attaching at the hip the Supreme Court to abortion in Roe v. Wade has, as Clark has indicated, really been damaging to the court. It's made this court into a perennial political issue. I mean, you think of all the political fights over going back to Robert Bork and the whole idea of Borking a justice. You want to keep off anyone who would vote against Roe v. Wade. How would the role of the court change in the future if the Supreme Court starts to detach itself from abortion? Can we expect then finally that we can have a more normal judicial confirmation process?
Yes. Obviously there are other legal issues or political hot issues that come before the court. You can think of gun control, the Second Amendment, and many other issues. But the single issue that since the Bork hearings in 1987 that has galvanized the left and created these campaigns of personal destruction against Bork and against Justice Thomas and against Justice Kavanaugh, that issue is abortion. And certainly the temperature would be lowered if the abortion issue was decentralized and the court released its grip on the abortion issue.
Yeah, but I agree. I mean, the Supreme Court does deal with a lot of important issues, especially social issues that people feel strongly about. They're dealing with a lot of important cases involving religious liberty. There's other things that have come before the court that people feel strongly about. And but again, I do think that the reason why judicial nominations have become so polarizing and so contentious and so divisive is because of the abortion issue. Again, we can't predict what will happen in the future. I do think if Roe v. Wade's overturned, our opponents probably will try to, put people on the court who would try to, frankly, restore Roe v. Wade. I think that's a possibility. But again, I do think that it would reduce the temperature a bit, and I think it would make the judicial confirmation process, frankly, a lot more reasonable and at least somewhat less contentious.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I thought to myself that maybe if you got rid of abortion at the Supreme Court, maybe about like, I don't know, I would estimate maybe about like 50% of the attention to the Supreme Court would go away. And you mentioned there, Michael, court packing, which is a theme that's come up in recent times. What would be the possibility for a court packing, and could the Democrats try to then reverse any decisions on abortion that would restrict the scope of the Roe v. Wade decision. How well would that go over?
First of all, yeah, I don't think that court packing is going to happen. I mean, I think it's a useful talking point that might be useful to generate money and attention from left of center political activists. But just by and large, the votes aren't there. I mean, I think, you know, Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia has been pretty clear that he opposes court packing. And I think that, you know, it could just really lead to an arms race. I think if Democrats would succeed expanding the size of the court and putting a lot of like-minded judges on the court, when the political winds blow a different direction, I think Republicans would probably do the same thing. And we would just get a expanded court where each side tries very hard to put people on the court sympathetic to their ideological opinion. So I don't think that's a terribly likely outcome. I think that, you know, it's a talking point. It may generate some money and some attention from activists, but I don't think there's going to be a serious push to engage in court packing.
Any thoughts on that, Clark?
No, I agree with Michael's observation. I suppose that if Roe was overturned, there might be more pressure from the left to pack the court, but I still don't see it succeeding, as Michael said.
Well, you know, we've talked a whole lot here about with this decision on Roe from 1973 about precedents and, you know, the whole argument about reliance. If over time this Roe decision is sort of whittled away and overturned, what effect would that have on, say, any other judicial precedents? I think about, you know, as Michael's indicated, you've had these other sort of hot button cultural issues. I mean, what about like the Obergefell decision on same-sex marriage? You know, that's a very new precedent. I mean, would a review of Roe and ultimate reversal, would that cause any sort of reconsideration of other kind of, you might say, judicial holy cows in the at the Supreme Court?
There's not really a direct connection between Roe and Obergefell. I mean, they deal with two different areas of law. The fall of Roe would not directly affect Obergefell. But if you look at Obergefell, I mean, it was a 5-4 decision, and there were four very strong dissents in that case by Roberts, Alito, Scalia, and Thomas. And 5-4 decisions are inherently fragile. Because the switch of one justice out of the five and replacement by another could affect a 5-4 decision, which is why, you know, unanimity or large majorities has always been important for protecting a decision going forward and showing acceptance, showing acquiescence. So I think Obergefell kind of rises or falls on its own, and it's not going to be directly affected by what the court does in Roe versus Wade.
All right, I'm kind of, you know, inclined to agree with Clark that I don't think that this is going to start really, you know, tipping over apple carts on other jurisprudence if Roe is overturned. And I also think that when you look at Obergefell, you kind of have to look at, you know, what people, you know, who are involved in the movement for traditional marriage are kind of doing. And it seems that, you know, their main priority since Obergefell has been kind of protecting religious liberty. You know, they're trying to protect the religious liberty of bakers and other professionals who have, you know, objections to same-sex marriage for religious or other reasons. So they're really, in my opinion, not investing significant capital in trying to reverse Obergefell. Again, the main priority of groups supporting traditional marriage has, again, been kind of upholding conscience rights and religious liberty rights.
And
yeah,
I would add that look at these some of these decisions and then ask, is there a organized movement to create a kind of litigation project or test cases in the courts to overturn Obergefell or overturn Griswold versus Connecticut or overturn Janus versus AFSCME and public sector unions? And there really isn't. Roe versus Wade stands out as instigating, sparking a judicial strategy and a test case strategy that survived for 48 years without let up, and that highlights Roe as such an egregious decision that stands out on its own.
Yeah, I remember Hadley Arkey's a leading pro-life advocate, a former professor of mine at Amherst College, and someone, of course, well known to both of you. You know, he wrote in one article that, you know, this Roe v. Wade decision, you know, this poison just simply has to be got out and out of the judicial system. I mean, that really speaks to, as Clark indicated, you know, this decision just can't stand. We've just got to get rid of it. And it sparked this massive opposition, this massive outcry. I mean, despite, as Michael indicated, you know, the justices thinking, oh, you know, the American people will accept this. And looking at Roe v. Wade, talking about numbers and decisions, that was indeed a 7-2 decision among the nine justices. Only Byron White and at the time William Rehnquist, justice before he became later chief justice, with the two dissenters. And then later in the 1992 Casey decision, that was also, again, of course, another 5-4 decision, a big disappointment for conservatives at the time, that I call, I guess, Kennedy, you know, sort of in the midst of it, as it was talked about, flipped his vote, his decision, later wrote the opinion with the famous mystery of life clause in it, that you know, you get to define, individuals get to define the meaning of life or whatever, as it was written. Well, just if looking at these appointments, judicial appointments and the politics of the court, again, if we're looking at, as you say, a more abortion skeptical court, does this really then vindicate those people who voted for President Donald Trump, that he will have a sort of, even with one term presidency, he's really shifted the ground dramatically on abortion at the Supreme Court?
Hello, Michael. Take this. I think that to be honest, it was interesting when Donald Trump was running for president. There were a lot of pro-life people who were skeptical. I mean, in the past, President Trump never seemed to show much interest in sanctity of life issues. In fact, there are even if you look around on YouTube, there are recordings of him saying that he did identify as pro-choice at one point and wouldn't even support a ban on partial birth abortion. So it was a bit of a plunge into the unknown. A lot of pro-lifers did support him, just knowing that Hillary Clinton would have been, frankly, a disaster on sanctity of life issues. So a lot of people made a prudential judgment to support Donald Trump. And, to a certain end, Trump certainly delivered on pro-life issues. He did a very good job. I mean, his judicial nominations, both the Supreme Court and the lower courts, I think, have been very good. I think he did some other good things, like in putting in place, again, the Mexico City policy. He was able to prevent Planned Parenthood from getting some of the Title X grants that they were accustomed to getting. And, that took tens of millions of dollars out of their coffers. So, again, I think that, people who supported Trump certainly have, again, we don't know how they'll rule in this Mississippi case, but we certainly have a Supreme Court that's certainly a lot more sympathetic to pro-life laws because of Donald Trump and the Trump presidency.
I would add that looking at across the history of administration since the 1980s, Trump is the latest of several that opposed Roe versus Wade and opposed abortion. I mean, the president's lawyer before the court is called the Solicitor General, and the Reagan Solicitor General, the Bush Solicitor General, both urged the court to overturn Roe versus Wade, and that opposition, combined with the opposition of the Trump administration, shows a history of presidential administrations opposing the decision, which is, again, is another factor showing that the decision has not been accepted. And that, combined with opposition of the states, judicial criticism, scholarly criticism, that is what makes Roe versus Wade today, despite being 48 years old, radically unsettled. And a radically unsettled decision like that does not deserve respect as precedent. And I expect the court, the justices, to focus on that in this upcoming Dobbs case and in future abortion cases. Roe is unsettled, and the court simply can't settle the issue.
Well, I guess in closing out here, that brings us then to an issue. What do you think that the Roe v. Wade decision, the history of it, says about the proper role of the judiciary in a free society? Like, for example, has any other country's Supreme Court state courts in the United States followed the Supreme Court in making a similar decision? Looking back historically on this decision, what should the role of the judiciary be?
I'm
very interested in what Michael has to say too. But I think it shows that at least the Supreme Court in the United States is on firmest ground when it adheres to the text of the Constitution and the text of congressional statutes, and tries to apply the original public understanding of the text of the Constitution. And in Roe versus Wade, it completely ignored that. And that's why it has suffered as the court has for 48 years, and why Roe has been such a disastrous decision.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Supreme Court, again, is on very strong ground when it makes decisions that are consistent with the text or the original meaning of the Constitution. You know, when they start looking at broad things like public opinion and, other kind of nebulous sorts of things, that leads to legislating from the bench, that leads to decisions that, are not well supported by either the text of the Constitution or the intentions of the Founding Fathers. And I think, society certainly has suffered, and politics has suffered because of Roe v. Wade. It has turned, judicial nomination process, frankly, into a bit of a circus. You see that in other countries where abortion is legal, it has typically come about through the democratic process. And, the decisions they've made weren't the decisions that I would have made. They're not the decisions that Clark would have made. But essentially, it's less contentious because, again, people who were pro-life, did have the opportunity to, make arguments and engage people. But here, we have legal abortion through judicial fiat, and pro-life Americans, by and large, have been kind of disenfranchised. And that's caused a lot of instability and a lot of disruption. And, again, I think would make American politics a lot healthier if Roe v. Wade would be overturned.
Yeah, I mean, Scalia, again, noted those points way back in the Casey decision of 1992 that, this was really a question of democracy, and that the court couldn't just sort of, as he argued, in a sort of a Nietzschean way, kind of order the American people, the folk, to obey their leadership and just follow the Supreme Court, and that the abortion had, as he wrote, enveloped the Supreme Court in this kind of fire and smoke of this issue of abortion, and it just simply had to be returned to the political arena where people, as Michael indicated, could have their say, could make their arguments, could if they lost, they could come back another day and try again. I think that's very important that this decision has not helped the American constitutional order or its democracy. Well, for all of our listeners out there, this has been another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show with your show host, Andrew Herod, where we like to discuss important issues of the day for conservatives and others. And today we've been talking about Roe v. Wade and the Supreme Court balance with Clark Forsythe, the senior counsel for Americans United for Life and author of the key book, Abuse of Discretion, The Inside Story of Roe v. Wade. And as well, we've been joined by our other new guest, Michael New, a professor at Catholic University and leading commentator on abortion issues at National Review Online and elsewhere. Well, Michael New and Clark Forsythe, thank you for joining the show.
Thank you, Andrew.
All right, for our listeners, tune in next Friday for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday.